Hi there, and welcome to Ungagged Interviews with me, Neil Anderson. This time round, we're interviewing Councillor Graham Campbell from the SNP. He's been on Ungagged many times and is always a good listen. But talking of a good listen, this is the Cundies. They are from Dundee, and this is Scheme Life. But beware, there is profanity. I'm doing well on yourself.
Yeah, I'm spelter.
So, you have now been elected for a second time to Glasgow City Council. It was the first time in 2017.
Correct. Yeah.
So, how has the experience been different from this May to now to 2017?
Well, you know what? The first thing is that I knew I was going to get elected because I'm alphabetically advantaged by on the ballot box because my name came up the top of the ballot paper. But the main thing that I think I'm quite pleased with is that we increased the SNP vote from the last time. This was a difficult election for the SNP for some obvious reasons in Glasgow. The press seemed to absolutely think that everything that ever went wrong in Glasgow only started going wrong when we came to office 5 years ago. Never mind the areas like mine where things were left for 40 odd years to go into decay, and then the equal pay was left for 12 years while these women were not being paid equally. But somehow that's only our fault because they only noticed it when we were in charge. So there was a lot of stuff. So against a really difficult background election and a really hostile press and a very unprincipled Labour campaign, in my view, we still won the election. So I think coming this time, it was more that we just hung on despite the pressure, but nationally overall, the trend is still with pro-independence, and what's interesting as well, a very strong pro-independence majority in the electorate, even here as well. The Greens did very well, so that was obviously, we didn't know prior to the election how well they would do, because obviously clearly now they have their own vote, that's the difference. So it means that probably in future we probably won't stand three candidates in a ward thinking that we might win a majority. So I think the days of any party really winning a majority on a council like Glasgow, that's gone now. I don't think anybody ever will be able to again. But the good thing about this time is that, of course, I'm an experienced councillor with a record to defend, and the problem I had 5 years ago was, I'm an activist who's become a politician, and that was a bit of a gap between becoming an anti-capitalist activist, an environmental activist, an anti-racist activist. I now have to implement a policy that I have to stand by and be elected on, and a manifesto, most of which I agree with, of course, but some of which I'm not so keen on. So I have to sort of defend all of it, and that's been okay. I mean, I anticipated there would be problems in the first, I was told, we'll have difficult budgets and all that. And as it's turned out, because we fought Glasgow's Corner really well with the government, and they've understood, for the sake of independence, that you need to actually make sure that Glasgow's resourced. So we've won some battles on that. And therefore, I'm happy that I haven't had to make any great compromises. We've fought to increase funding as far as we could within the limitations, and we've managed to keep to the promise of no compulsory redundancies, keep services going as far as we could, deal with the COVID pandemic, which is a disaster for everybody, but we've managed to do it without any major pain and suffering for the workforces. So that I'm quite proud of. And we've still implemented equal pay during the course of it, which is an important thing. So we've solved some major problems with everything that's been thrown at us. So I'm quite proud of the record we have. Now, it's pretty clear, ahead, it's going to be difficult for us because everything, we'll talk about it in a bit, but I suppose the cost of living crisis, the consequences of Brexit, the consequences of the global climate change, all of these things are having massive impacts on what will happen this next term.
Very much. And you have now been made, as an experienced councillor, now been made convener of the Education Committee in the council. What are your aims?
Well, the first thing I can say is that one thing I won't be doing is one of my first meetings will in fact be the meeting with the unions to just talk about the teachers' pay. And obviously, it's not in the control of the council because we've got national pay bargaining. But what I won't be doing is offering them a derisory pay increase. That's one thing I'm not going to be doing. I'm not going to sit across the table and insult people's intelligence. So that's the first thing. Teachers, like everybody else, need a pay rise that meets the situation that we're in. So obviously I see the justice in that, and obviously I'm coming from that perspective. That I support the right to strike, and I support the workers who've taken the action, and I totally understand why council workers will feel they'll need to. So you're coming with that perspective to education, but also around the issues of schools. So I'm very passionate about fighting racism and equalities issues in schools, and I've been a supporter of the Thai campaign, and I love the way that campaign has mainstreamed LGBT plus education and support and peer support within schools. So on the Education Committee, we've already helped to do that in a sort of for anti-racism clubs. So we've got anti-racism networks now in schools and between teachers and for pupils, and many schools have started to put their anti-racism plans into effect. So since last year they've had to have one, each school now has to have one, and to have a clear one that sort of spells out how they're going to tackle things, how they tackle incidents, how they report them, how they involve parents and how they involve students. So that's something I'm on working on and keeping going on. The curriculum, we've just in April there changed the modern studies curriculum, so it now includes modules on the slavery legacy of Scotland, and also the story of the Glasgow girls, so this whole struggle around John Chaffer and my colleague Councillor Rosa, who's just become a councillor, so tells her story, so it's now being told to school kids in the schools now. So these things have been added to the modern studies curriculum already. So I'm hoping that going ahead, now that I'm chair of it, I want to make more of a focus on equalities, also just thinking outside the box. So obviously we're going to be talking about social inequality and narrowing the attainment gap, and how realistic is that as an aim? That's a national policy, obviously, but in the context we're in, you can't really expect schooling and education itself to solve problems that are problems in the wider society. A school cannot possibly, no school teacher can be expected to counterbalance the inequalities of poverty, income, households, lack of access to laptops and computers, or even electricity and food, as it might go ahead. An education system can't do that.
Yeah. Well, as a school teacher myself, I'm very glad to hear you say that, because I think the emphasis has been a lot of time too much on what can be done in schools, and as you say, it's a far wider problem.
I mean, there's a story, a good story to be told. Because one thing that we get in committees, right, is we get reports from the officers, and they're very good at reporting the good news. And they will report the good news of the amazing attainment that we have got. I mean, we have got record numbers of working class kids from inner city comprehensive schools from humble backgrounds going to university and further education. The destinations, the record on destinations and results of N5s is very good in Glasgow, despite everything that's been thrown at us. We've actually done really well and maintained the progress we've had. You know, we are narrowing the gap between, you know, the most successful students and the, you know, ones on the, you know, the, what they call the lowest decile. That annoying term about people who live in the poorest areas, the most high income deprivation. So students from those backgrounds are doing really well in school, and I do support, I mean, we just had the retirement of the former Director of Education, Maureen McKenna, in January, February there, and we've got a new director now who's come in from South Lanarkshire, and he's seems to be continuing the nurture approach to schools and the general principles. We just had an education committee there where we're going to come up with the first committee under my chairmanship, and we're going to sort of look at maintaining those principles, but seeing how we can adapt them to whatever new policy comes along. It seems to me that the general principles about how we do it, the nurturing environment and that policy around, you know, making treating holistically how a child is schooled. You know, it's a community that you have to think about in that broad sense. But one of the important things that's going to happen is the reduction of teacher workload, and I'm sure that's something that you're aware of, that we've been told now we've got to reduce by, I think, an hour and a half a week for contact time. That's an important issue, and obviously to reduce it by that amount, I understand that Scottish teachers, from comparisons of international, are amongst the highest in terms of contact time. It's 800 hours of contact a week, which is, it seemed, I was...
Not a week, but it's
a large amount. But it's compared to other European countries, it's, you know, it's at least 30% higher than nearly every other European country. So we have the most contact time pretty much in Europe, and that is a big burden on teachers. So I'm going to look at that. We are already going to have to reduce it by an hour and a half. But the more contact time you reduce by, that means you have to employ more teachers. So that should mean that we should get extra resources to employ more teachers to make this policy possible. I don't know any more details yet, because I'm just new to the post. I'm not an educationist, but I'm looking into this and think, oh, well, that's a good thing. Yeah, I want to reduce the teacher work time burden. I want to decrease the stress on them. And we want to do this in a way that will work. But to do that, it needs to be resourced.
Yes. That is the difficult thing in these times.
Don't worry, I'm good at asking for money.
Good. We've talked previously before about reparations for slavery in the UK and Glasgow University in particular. Can you give us an update on what anything that's been happening around that area?
Well, I don't know if anybody's noticed, but I'm aware that lots of you don't know this, but in March the 31st, the last council meeting before the election, we received Dr. Stephen Mullen's report Dr. Stephen Marlin is the guy who did the Glasgow University report in 2018, which led to their reparative justice efforts. Yes. And he'd co-authored that with Professor Simon Newman. And that report, the Glasgow Slavery Audit, it was called, I think it was called. And it laid out the degree to which Glasgow University's main campus was subsidised by slave owner interest money. Yes. And he calculated about £200 million worth of DOSH was donated to the university from these interests, from just, I think, 24 donations, I think it was, from particular families, like the Coates family of Paisley, who were deep into cotton slavery in cotton. Yep. So that's one example. So he did that report in 2018. It led to Glasgow University fessing up its role in it and then setting up a partnership with the University of the West Indies in Kingston, Jamaica. They've signed a memorandum of understanding. We raised the Jamaican flag, and this led to a stone being laid at the Glasgow University Chapel and the establishment of a slavery studies centre called the Beniba Centre, which is jointly managed between the two universities. Yeah. So that came as a result of Stephen's report. Yeah. So we've done a similar thing with our own report. Now, before the pandemic, we commissioned this report to try and do something about Glasgow and look at Glasgow City Council and its previous iterations, like the Corporation and the original Town Council, and obviously lots of Lord Provosts of Glasgow. I think Stephen's report has found, I think, about 20 or 30 of them, I forget the exact number, but a huge number of them were involved directly in slavery as tobacco, sugar or cotton interested merchants. So he calculated the amount that Glasgow City Council itself was involved in, and again it's in the tens and tens of millions, so it categorically appears that Glasgow had its hands and dipped fully in the blood of slavery. So we as a corporation for the first time officially apologised in the resolution recognising the report. So we did that on March the 31st, and on 31st March Glasgow City Council formally apologised unreservedly, unanimously, including the Tories. There was eight of them then, there's only two of them now. So, but they were nice enough to support it, and actually, unanimously, Glasgow has apologised to the African Caribbean Community of Scotland for Glasgow's role as a council in slavery. Yeah. So that's happened, but I think almost nobody knows that. So there will be some event I think we'll do in October to sort of more formally mark that. Yeah. But as well as that, I've been running the Slavery Legacy Working Group for the last year and a half, and on that committee is representatives of the African Caribbean community, historians, we've got Stephen's on it as well, and we've been taking advice and soundings from Liverpool and Bristol for the last, we started with them and we looked at their experiences and how they went about the process. And both those cities, the black community had to organise itself, campaign for decades and decades and decades. And we wanted to do it in a more grassroots way, and we took their advice about how to consult. Mm-hmm. And we're consulting on street names, statues, names of the quarter, like the merchant cities, what that called. But so we've been asking questions about that. So what's already happened is that we've already put five questions in the household survey, which you may have done this, but the household survey that went out in the spring there, we put five questions in from our committee, which are related to the slavery legacy, asking people what their views are. So we'll get a sort of sounding of what the general Glasgow public thinks. We've been consulting at small scale focus groups from the African Caribbean communities, we've been doing that. The BAME community is currently now being consulted in similar ways. We will then go to a general consultation for the official council consultation about this legacy, but we're first waiting for one. I think my first meeting is coming later this month of the committee, and then we will get a report back of these findings from the household survey, so we get a sense of where we are now. And what the intention is that each year's household survey we will ask the same question, so we'll get a sense of how that opinion moves in response to our consultations. So we are actively doing this in a way which is properly including the Glasgow public in the discussion. We're not giving a prescribed view. If you go on the website of the council, you can see, if you type in slavery legacy, you'll see the pricey SAF done about the work we've done over the last few years, so you get a sense of what's going on with museums and galleries, with the Coalition for Racial Equality and Rights. They have been campaigning for a museum for marking the slavery legacy for 20 years. Yes. They've been campaigning for that. So they are in the middle of still doing that campaign. We're working with them. They're on the committee as well. So we've got a good representative bunch of people meeting now every couple of months, mm-hmm. and we're monitoring the progress with equalities officers and museums and galleries mm-hmm. to make sure that we have something representative in our museum space. So we're discussing with the public, they'll get their say, we'll make some decisions. There's options we could have. There's, you know, the, obviously the option many people would say is that we should have plaques saying who Buchanan is or who these statues are, yeah. QR codes. There are things we can do which are relatively cheap. So we're looking for ways to do this. We're not saying that street signs will all be removed or statues will all be removed. We're not saying that. We don't need to do a Bristol, but what we do need is have a recognition. I should point out briefly, I'll try and be brief, but Bristol had a 20-year process where eventually it took a black mayor and a black-led convener to of the city council's committee to finally action the community's demand to get rid of Colston statue. So it made that decision 2 years before. But because the black community in Bristol didn't have the political clout to make it happen, it just wasn't prioritised. But eventually, once the community prioritised it by repurposing the statue of Colston, we don't want people to feel they need to do that. What we're saying is we're listening, we're talking. We're also going to listen to the concerns that people have about not erasing our history, because obviously people are worried that if you just simply remove all the signs that slave merchants and slave owners were responsible for Glasgow's wealth. If you removed every trace of that, then how would people remember it? How would they know? This question of how to remember is an important thing. And my general experience has been that the more people find out about this in Glasgow, their attitude has generally been, I want to know more. I want to know why I didn't know before. And what are you going to do about making sure I know?
When I first heard about anything and first started talking to you about it, that was exactly my reaction. I wanted to find out more, and why hadn't we, you know, admitted it or highlighted it previously?
Now you can say, we've admitted it, we've fessed up, we're at the first stage of the reparative justice journey, as we call it. But reparative justice, we don't know where the end of that journey will be, but this is a start. So I always say this, it's not the final thing. Just because we apologise, that's not the end of it. There's a process to this, and we're now engaged in that public consultation element of that process.
Because certainly my memory of, you know, growing up in Glasgow was the reformers of slavery that were highlighted. And that was a good thing, and that in Glasgow started that, and these people did early. But it wasn't mentioned, Glasgow's involvement in it, to counteract, saying, oh, these are good people, they were from Glasgow. They talk about the other side.
It is a shame that people in Scotland in general probably don't know who Thomas Clarkson was, because he was probably more important than Wilberforce at the time, you know, at those times that you remember Wilberforce. And people don't know who Reverend Ralph Wardlaw was, the Baptist pastor who was the major anti-slavery figure in Glasgow at the time when Glasgow was dominated by the West India sugar merchants. I should put that in a way that Dr. Stephen Mullen is the expert on the West India sugar merchants, and his book is coming out this autumn, and it will become, I'm sure, the definitive book on the subject. But basically, that tells you who the pro-slavery people was. And Glasgow was the second most important centre for pro-slavery politics. So the city was divided, and so trying to remember that there were abolitionists as well, that's important. So that's part of the re-remembering. And my friends Dr. Eva Jackson from Glasgow Cali and my friend Adam Sula Ramsey, the artist, they came up with this phrase about the organised forgetting that we've had in Glasgow, and now we've got organised remembering.
Yes. Oh, well, that's good. Right. And the times we have talked before, you always have quite a lot of projects or things on the go. So what other things or projects do you're involved in?
Things! Where do I start? I've been involved in a lot of Ukraine solidarity work. So on the day the war broke out, I was there with the Ukrainian community for the first 10 days of the war, every day, pretty much. I managed to get the council leader and also the Lord Provost at the time to help get the Ukrainian flag raised and to support the Ukrainian people that are here. And we've seen the Ukrainian community go from basically about 500 in the whole of the west of Scotland to several thousand now, suddenly, overnight. So I've been involved quite a lot in trying to help that community to sort of get its bearings, and was in supporting to a reasonable extent, but obviously now the government has been sponsoring them. I've been involved in issues around the hotel accommodation. I tried to deal with some of the issues. We had a couple of rallies in April, and there where my input has been to make sure that refugees from other countries are represented on those platforms. Yeah. And we have been able to get Afghans and African refugees to speak on these Ukrainian platforms to make that point that this racial privilege of being a white European is some irony about this. So that's been an important campaign I've been involved in. I've also been involved in anti-racism campaigns with to do with education in Edinburgh, actually, and in Glasgow and in other places. So I've been involved in this parent-led campaign, and we've been trying to highlight the racism in schools. And so I'm still involved in that, but I'm doing that mainly through my education work here. So that involves looking at the teacher training that we offer and also the support to parents and students to form anti-racist clubs in schools. I've been involved also in a nurses issue. The Royal Edinburgh Hospital has been having a real problem with institutionalised racism. There are black nurses who have been basically off work because of bullying and racist discrimination at work, and I've been working with a group of them to hold the health board to account. So I've been going there every few weeks or so to try and help that group to galvanise itself. I went to the bio inquiry and supported the family there as much as I was able to. Obviously, it was difficult to with a full time commitment as a counsellor, but I've managed to get over there a couple of times and still support the family during the first stage of the inquiry. The next stage of the inquiry is coming. I've got police based cases that I'm trying to deal with in my casework, which are proving to be difficult. We had COP26, so I was there trying to push the police about how their methods of catching and policing and their intelligent choices to victimise people of a certain political persuasion. It's funny how they manage not to do that to the far right. So and I'm pointing that out to them, to their faces. So I oppose them on things like the using of tasers, and that's been an issue which I'm dealing with a case which involves that, which I can't say too much about it now, but I will in a future podcast probably talk about the full involvement in this case, because it's a proper Black Lives Matter issue, and I want to properly deal with it when I'm able to properly talk about it. But it's a, the Sheikh Ubaya should have been a wake-up call, and it will be in terms of once the inquiry's over in a couple of years' time, but right now we have a problem with policing because we still have the same rules that applied when Sheikh Ubaya was killed. So a Sheikh Ubaya could happen again, and unless anti-racism campaigners in Scotland properly do their thing and make sure that the police aren't allowed to get away with unaccountable politicised policing.
Yes.
And I'd be blunt about that, because my concern is that. Now, it's not quite as bad as it is down south. That's great. We don't have the degree of, that obviously that awful policing bill that my partner Anne and other SNP MPs have been opposing, their illiberal policies all these times, and this ridiculous government that we've got down in London. They're evil class warriors, and they're showing themselves to be, but we're in that sort of small drift towards very authoritarian populist right-wing government down there. We're probably already there, and Scotland's choice is very obvious that we've got to leave it. But so I'm kind of involved in that level. But I've got my fingers in a lot of pies around environment, and I'm still sort of looking at the things I'm involved in. But I'm going to have to try and make some room to campaign for independence.
Yes, indeed. And on that, you think Scottish independence would make a difference to the current cost of living crisis and Brexit and so on? Do those two strengthen the case for an independent Scotland?
Well, clearly, every time we talk about the cost of living crisis or its impact or Brexit's impact, and nearly always there's a price tag attached to the things that we would like to do to remedy it. And quite right, people say the things that local government does is so important to the community that it needs to be resourced properly. They'll say that, quite rightly, the workers who work in the public sectors that we clapped for during the pandemic actually need to be paid properly. They're so vital on the front line, and you pay them properly. But to do that, you need to be able to raise the taxes off the rich and off the ordinary people who can afford to pay taxes. That needs to be, you need to be able to control those levers of taxation. You also need to be able to control the fiscal levers, to be able to control your own budget. We don't control our own budget. Where we do control it, for example, we've just taken over the responsibility for adult disability payments at the end of this month, so because we've got a more humane social security system, we've set up based on consultations with people who are, have lived experience of having to deal with the UK benefit system. And we've set up a system which is entirely opposite to that. And the kind of people we've got working for it. That different kind of different mindset in terms of how they treat people with dignity and respect. So we've set up a system where we've got the power and we are able to make those payments. We have a more generous system. We, you know, if you're a council taxpayer or a benefit recipient in Scotland, you're in a slightly better position than our brothers and sisters down south. And that's because we have some degree of autonomy and independence over those financial matters. Now, it's obvious that we are to properly deal with all of the impacts of it. You know, poverty, inequality, fuel poverty. We cannot deal with that without control over those things. We don't control energy prices. We don't control the regulations around these things. You know, fuels, taxation, you know, the taxes on it. We don't control that. We've called for tax VAT to be got rid of on fuels to ease the bills. We're asking for a windfall tax, not just for the oil companies and the energy companies, actually for all the companies that had a windfall from the pandemic, because, you know, it's retailers, you know, Amazon, people like that have made an absolute killing from it. Yeah. So they should be taxed properly in Scotland. Now, if we had the capacity to do that, we would have the money. You know, we're a country with a $200 billion economy. Right? We only spend about maybe, you know, we spend $40 billion directly in our own coffers, you know, from the government. But let's be generous, the UK government spends about the same, $80 billion. It's still not even half of our annual GDP. So it's well, you know, we are a rich country capable of actually, you know, most countries would be borrowing at 100% of their GDP. If we had borrowed at 100% of our GDP, we'd be able to double public spending. I'm not saying we should, but I'm saying that it's clear that we can afford to be. Yeah. The very fact that we don't have those levers of independence powers at our own parliament means we can't actually raise that money. It means that we're stuck with a government down there which will decide how much we're allowed to spend of our own money. And that's just untenable. So anybody who's going up there in that parliament saying, oh, it's terrible the S&P aren't doing this, it's terrible the S&P aren't doing this. It may well be terrible that we aren't doing as much around drugs death in particular. That's something I'm very passionate about. So people in Springburn are amongst the main campaigners around these questions. You know, we park crosses every year in the ground at Springburn Parish Church. So it's something that directly affects my community more than most others. So it's something I want to do something about that. But to pay for rehab, we need to invest literally tens of millions in that. To do that, we have to have more money than our government does have.
Yes.
Where are we going to get that from if we don't control the economy? How are you control the economy if you're not an independent country? Because we're not going to get those powers from Westminster. It's pretty clear that we're not going to be devolved that power, and it's pretty clear that anytime soon this government, which has caused the Brexit crisis by their idiocy, now blaming France, the European Union, the SNP, anybody else for the things that they argued for, which was to put a border up at Dover. And surprise, surprise, I remember what it was like before the single European market and access, when you used to drive to France and to go for your school holidays, and you spend 8 hours waiting in Dover, and then another probably couple of hours after an 8 hour very, very slow ferry journey. Yes. And then it would take you the whole of your first day just to cross the channel. And that's what it's become like, because that's what we argued for. Yes. Thank you, Britain. That's what we got from you guys. So, surprise, surprise, they're doing the things you asked us to do. So, yes, you are in the third queue that's bloody great being long, and you're not being whizzed through with your passports while you go through the airport.
Yes.
Well, that's what you voted for down south. It's what we voted against in Scotland.
Yes.
So we need to be back in Europe, because that's clear. You see this with Ireland. They've so thrived. They were a country which was completely dependent on their exports to England, mostly agriculture exports, when they joined the EEC in 1973. Look at them now. Their exports to Europe are way more important than their exports to England. So that could be us easily in a few years. And we're already starting from a rich base of having control of energy in a major way, both fossil fuel and renewable. We are one of the few countries that can make the transition, the just transition, to a fully 100% renewable energy-based economy. We could do that with social justice. We have the powers to do it. We have the facilities, not powers. We have the ability to do it, but we lack the powers.
And
that's the point. We could make one of the quickest journeys in remedying climate change. We could meet the 2045 target, I think, pretty easy. I think we can do it sooner. Yeah. But we can't do it sooner without full independence, and that's the point. Anybody who says anything about those questions, well, the constitutional question always comes up in every social issue, even anti-racism. Look at the idiots you've got running anti-racism policy in London. You've got black spokesmen for white power, as what these people are, people like Kerry Badenoch and Kwasi Kwarteng, and they're the politically whitest black people you could possibly have. But they are basically people who've got massive privilege, who've had very privileged lives themselves, they speak for their class, and they're there to divide the working class and exploit them as everybody else is in that regime. But they're there because, you know, they are fighting a culture war against anti-racism, because they want us to all be divided and blame foreigners and blame black people and keep people in this position that they've been in the UK today. Scotland wants to have more refugees, wants to have a more inclusive, integrated society. Scottish people want that. That's been proven by the way they've voted. Yeah. But we don't have the powers over our borders and immigration. We need to have those powers to grow our population, to have more people come in, not less. You know, so that's what we want. Yeah. To have that, we need independence. Mm.
So on that, and voting, the Scottish Government wants to have another independence referendum next year, in 2023. But Westminster Government doesn't want it to happen. Do you think, will we be able to have a referendum? And how do you think the campaign vote will go when we hopefully do?
Okay, I'm sort of hedged on this. I think, obviously, I'm very glad that a date has been set. You know, for years and years and years and years and years, both members and non-members of the party have been arguing, "Never should set a date, never set a date. Ah, she doesn't really want independence, she doesn't want to set a date." Now she set a date, they're still thinking. But I think it was right for her not to during the pandemic. Of course, nobody should have had a referendum during the pandemic. It's a daft idea. So anybody thinks it should have happened sooner, they're just not serious political people. But the serious point about whether it's legal, and that's the key point here. Nicola's very clear about having a legally authorised referendum so that it is recognised internationally.
Yes.
And also for us internally as a society, we know that the reason why the last referendum actually worked quite well as a democratic exercise, and so many people registered to vote, got engaged in discussion on both sides, you know, the idea that it was a divisive, no, it actually energised families to discuss politics, discuss what they wanted. Yes, they disagreed. God, when do we not disagree about stuff? But the point is that people were engaged in the political process in a way we've never seen before. More people turned out in that referendum than any other vote we ever had, right? So it's not a trifle. So we can't ignore the fact that people voted no in a certain set of circumstances. Those circumstances are very different now, 8 years on. So obviously, and we've got a mandate. We've got all these mandates. We've got plenty of mandates. But this particular one that we've got in 2021 is more significant in this way. The first time a majority of the electorate actually voted for pro-independence parties, ourselves and the Greens, with an actual numerical majority of the electorate. And a record number of people voted for the SNP, over 1 million people. So there's no way anybody can say that it's not the will, expressed will, the Scottish people have a referendum. So we've got a democratic, legitimate mandate with a majority of Parliament and a majority of the electorate. It's the first time that's ever happened. I think that's not stressed enough, the fact that that's unprecedented. Yep. We once said that if we had a majority of Westminster MPs, that we would declare UDI. We've had a majority of Westminster MPs now for, 2015?
Yes.
For three consecutive elections. Mm. So, you know, there's no doubt that a large percentage of our public wants independence, or at least wants to vote on it. It's the only democratic option. But the question, and I'm very glad that the government has taken, our government, that is the Scottish government, has gone to the court itself and asked for a ruling on our right to hold it. I think this is the thing. We know that in the British Constitution, there is no constitutional right to have referendums. Referendums don't have legal standing. All the referendums we ever had are licences to consult public opinion, giving the government grounds to negotiate something. That's what referendums are. So when we lost the Brexit referendum, the UK government then had to negotiate its exit from the European Union. And it would be the same for us. You know, if we had won in 2014, our government would have been given the right to. But I think the right to consult the public is there for the government. We've established that. We've already set the question. We've confirmed that question's legal. We've confirmed that we can decide the franchise, as we did last time. So 16-year-olds and for the first time, 400,000 foreign national residents mm-hmm. will be able to vote in the mm-hmm. defence referendum. So unlike other elections. So it would be the most democratic referendum there's ever been in these islands. So I'm not only hopeful it will go ahead, I'm quite certain a vote of some kind will go ahead. The question is whether it will be recognised, and that's the thing. The Spanish are always put forward as a sort of EU blocker on this, but they always say as long as it's legal and constitutional, they won't go with the decision. Mm. And, you know, so I don't see any problem. I think we will have the vote. I do think that we will have it. And the campaign for it now, which has already been up and running, yes, Scotland has been very active. Groups like Believe in Scotland have been very good at arguing the economic case. There's the beginnings of a group called Socialist for Independence, which we in SNP Socialists are part of. And we've been working jointly with Socialist Greens like Maggie Chapman and Peter McCall. We've worked quite closely with them. Mm-hmm. We've worked with them in the Aberdeen Movement for Independence. So there's a good cross-section of far-left and socialist people within cross-parties all working together to provide that perspective around independence. So there will be different campaigns doing this. I suppose we have to face facts that there will be several different campaigns. There's not going to be one unified yes campaign. There will be a predominantly SNP and Green campaign backed by the government, which will probably be through Yes Scotland. Yes, Mike Russell's been the main voice person for that. So there'll be a mainstream campaign around that. There'll be local Yes groups, obviously, and there'll be a Yes family of groups which are still going. There'll be the Thomas Sheridan support club thing that will carry on, you know, whatever it is. There'll be the all under one banner, which is basically not all under and not all encompassing if you're not a head case. So they're not going to encompass as much as they think they will. But people will march and they will do those things. It's important that we still do that. And I also think it's really important that the flag element of it, you know, the feeling about national independence and pride in the country isn't left to those marginal groups. Mm-hmm. I actually think that the mainstream parties now have to, and the SNP and the Greens need to mobilise their own followers to show that there's mass support for this. Yeah. Because I think people know that, but they have no way of expressing it now, because they've done it through the ballot box and it's being ignored. When Liz Truss says she will ignore the First Minister, it's not ignoring Nicola, she's ignoring all of us, the 5 million of us. Uh-huh. We don't count in their thinking about where their Brexit Ireland is going, so we need to show them. And I've said it once in public already, and I'll say it again, I think we should send 100,000 Scots down to London Parliament Square and dig up their turf and bring it back.
Yeah, that'd be good.
So I think that's one of the things we should argue for, because I think Parliament down there needs to feel the weight of our people. Now, of course, our SNP MPs are doing their very best and showing it, and it's great that Ian Bradford does his straight-back defence of our interests, and you see the Tories braying at him every time, but been a bit quiet of late, haven't they?
He's good at that.
He's done that job, and I think people say, oh, why are we down there? But it's important that is being done, because it shows to the people who didn't understand. We know all this, because we know. If you've been supporting independence for a long time, you know that that's what they're about. But for many people, they're only coming to this realisation now, just how disrespected Scotland is. And it's important that our MPs are there taking that disrespect, showing that reactionary institution for what it is, and not democracy, which is what it is, challenging our democratic rights and freedoms, because it's Scotland's powers that have been grabbed. It's that colonial office in Edinburgh which needs to be staked out and surrounded, in my view. We need to do some civil disobedience to stop them operating, because that's a colonial governor's office, and that's how they're behaving. They're riding roughshod over reserved and devolved matters that should be the Scottish Parliament's purview. That's what's clearly where this trust is pointing, probably where Sunak's pointing as well. Whoever's Prime Minister down there, they're not going to respect our Parliament and our democracy. So we have to take our Parliament and democracy in our hands. So I think the balance between what we do in the government and what we do in the parties and what we do in the Yes movement as a whole, it needs to be a bit more targeted and focused and more visible as a campaign. So I hope that in the next year, you will see the local groups being re-established, but more being networked properly, and having a platform for this important thing. Obviously, some people have taken umbrage with this, but I think it's right that the code of conduct that the Aberdeen Independence Movement wanted to impose on the, on how we debate. Mm-hmm. You know, and I've no problem with debating people with political parties I don't agree with. I made a point of trying to do that before they formed their party. Yeah. I debated regularly with people who are now in other organisations, and I said, look, let's talk to each other, but let's not demonise each other. Of course we shouldn't, but mm-hmm. we should. But let's remember who our target is. Let's mm-hmm. keep our eyes on the prize. Remember who the target is. Let's spend as much energy and time attacking the British state and the establishment as we do each other. If we did even half as much, then we'd get much closer to the goal of independence.
Yeah. Right, fantastic. Been thoroughly interesting to speak to you as always. Thank you very much for your time.
You're welcome.
A few quid keeps us going. Donate at paypal.me/ungaggedleft.